This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We talk often about the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana and a lot about the operations at the warehouse in Broadway in Merrillville. And when people come by, parking in many cases along the street, waiting for the donation time to open up and people to receive the food that they would like to take home with them. We don't always talk that much about the mobile markets, and they're all over Northwest Indiana. The Food Bank of Northwest Indiana is very responsible in making sure that people do their best to have something available so they can take home and feed their families. And with us to talk about the mobile markets and the importance of them, we have Victor Garcia. He is Executive Director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Victor, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
The mobile markets are a very interesting concept. They're everywhere, but in particular, they get a lot of people involved, not only volunteers, but clients, people in Northwest Indiana who need to feed their families with the right kind of food to be able to get by these days. Tell us how important the mobile markets are and how the mobile markets themselves are set up so that people can come by and pick up something to eat.
Absolutely. So mobile market distributions have been something we've been doing for quite some time. However, as part of our response to the COVID pandemic, we really upped the number of distributions we were doing in 2020. And what we've identified is we were able to leverage the increased opportunities of mobile market distributions to have an impact on the barriers that some of our neighbors have in access to transportation. So the idea behind our mobile markets is we load up a truck or a refrigerated van, and we go to a specific area in our service area of Lake or Porter County, and we do a food distribution. Now, prior to the pandemic, we were doing two distributions a week, and during the pandemic, we started doing anywhere between 5 and 7 per week. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're doing between 4 and 6. So we've been able to decrease a little bit. However, we've identified that it's so important that we allow for that access to food supports that we've continued operating 4 to 6 times a week. And each mobile market distribution is able to serve anywhere between 100 households and 500 households. It depends on what size vehicle we take and the size of the partner parking lot. Mm-hmm. So it's really critical, Chris, that we are able to identify partner organizations throughout our service area that are willing to host a mobile market distribution because, as you had mentioned earlier, our distributions are still in drive-through service mode, which means we need large parking lots and ways that we can have minimal impact on traffic.
How does the ethnic makeup of the clients, the people that come by asking for items from the food bank, is made up? And which neighborhoods tend to be the ones that need the help the most these days?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. So part of mobile market is that we're able to target specific areas. And so we're all over our service area. So you can look at the demographics of any community and you're going to see that's what our distribution is going to look like. So, you know, distribution in Lowell is going to look a little different than it looks like in Valparaiso, than a little different than it looks like in Hammond, mm-hmm. right? Now, what we do know is that historically Latino, Native American, Black, and some Asian households have been disproportionately affected by food insecurity compared to white households. Now, between 2019 and 2020, there was a deepening divide across those racial and ethnic lines, and food security improved for white, non-Hispanic households. However, it worsened for Black and Latino households. So we've been really trying to identify ways that we can target our mobile distribution so that we can have really just so that we can get those resources out to the areas that need it the most. Now, that doesn't mean we're ignoring other areas. We are going throughout our service area, and that's the advantage of still being out 4 to 6 times a week. We can get out to just about everywhere we need to be. And one unique thing that we've done recently is United Way of Northwest Indiana has funded a very short-term project, but we're really excited about this. We have added, instead of looking at just the racial or ethnic demographics of an area, we're looking at ways that we can get to people that may have additional barriers. So we are launching a mobile market distribution specifically targeting homeless individuals. Mm-hmm. And we've also launched mobile market distributions that are targeting mobile home communities so that we can bring those access to those food supports to those areas.
You mentioned earlier about the fact that the Hispanic community in Northwest Indiana, along with the Black community, are some of the hardest to be able to get taken care of, to get the food insecurity issues dealt with. What seem to be the problems in particular with the Hispanic community? Why is it so difficult to be able to get them to come out when the food, the mobile markets are out there, to get the food they really need?
Yeah, sure. So one thing that we have found anecdotally, Chris, is that there's still a little bit of a concern about sharing personal information. And while we are in the business of making sure people have the food support that they need, we do have a registration process. So with our mobile market distributions, we do require proof of residency.
Right.
The easiest way to do that is through an ID. However, not everybody wants to show an ID, and that's okay. A piece of mail, something with a name, will qualify someone. And the reason we bring this up is the largest food support inventory that we have is the Emergency Food Assistance Program, which is a federal program operated through the State Department of Health. There are restrictions to that. We can only serve Indiana residents. But we always, I shouldn't say always, but we almost always have either purchased food or donated food on our mobile distributions in case we come across someone who cannot show proof of Indiana residency or maybe isn't an Indiana resident. And I'll give you a quick example.
Okay.
When we're out in, say, downtown Hammond, because that area is so close to the state line, sometimes we come across some Illinois residents. And while we cannot support those neighbors with the Emergency Food Assistance Program product, we can support them with inventories that were either donated or we had purchased. So we believe that we will never turn someone away who's hungry. We just may need to find a different way to support that individual household.
When you do need an ID from someone so they can pick up what's available through the program, what kinds of IDs are you encouraging folks to bring that would be able to get them to be able to pick up whatever is available that day?
Yeah, sure. So the easiest thing is a driver's license or a state ID. A passport work if you have something from the consulate, that would be fine as well, as long as it shows that you're an Indiana resident. Again, we're not saying an Indiana citizen. We're saying an Indiana resident. But the other piece it could be a piece of mail, and it doesn't matter where that mail is coming from. So even if it's a piece of junk mail that has your name on it with your address on it, that will qualify for the food distribution.
Or doctor's bill or something like that, I suppose. Whatever,
yeah,
you get in the mail, yeah, it's fine. When you've had these opportunities to deal with some of these issues on an individual basis at the mobile markets, how successful has it been? People gone away and been happy with what they've been able to receive?
Well, we really work on making sure that we are building a culture of customer service here at the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. So we don't turn anyone away. Everyone is going to get served while supplies last. So we're very, very adamant on that. We have not turned any households away that are looking for food supports through our mobile market distributions. But we do encourage individuals, if they maybe are lacking the appropriate documentation that we need, that if they need access to these programs and systems in the future, that they know how to gain access to the proper documentation that they need.
Well, Victor, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the mobile markets that are available through the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana and how important it is, of course, for people to take part in when they're available in the neighborhood. They can learn about it, of course, with many neighborhood services when they come by. They can, I'm sure, if they have an opportunity, they can check the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana website and find out when the next mobile market is going to be in a particular neighborhood. And we thank you for talking about it today with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
And now let's find out more about the Gary Chamber of Commerce and the partnership between the Gary Eastside Community Development Corporation and the Computer Skills and Training Center to help young people be ready for the jobs of the future and better housing opportunities. I spoke recently with the Chamber President and CEO, Chuck Hughes, and one of the founders of the Eastside Community Development Corporation, Dr. Marlon Mitchell, about what could be a life-changing opportunity for many people in the city of Gary. We hear first from Chuck Hughes.
Dr. Mitchell is an educator, an administrator, person who's been involved in Northwest Indiana, and particularly the Gary community. I mean, we're both natives, and so we have this inherent love for our community. Now, they are doing some remarkable things. He and Pastor Dennis Walton who are leading this charge, but certainly they have some partners who are helping them as well. And as it relates to the chamber, they are chamber members, both of them have been a long time, and that's where the chamber's affiliation takes place. But the impetus for this project stems from them, their efforts, and the partners that they've engaged. And as a chamber executive, I am just extremely excited about what it is they choose to do. It has a lot to do with business, education. It has a myriad of things to do to help people in general in the community. And so having the chamber as a part of it is important to the chamber and important to the business community. And so what I will do at this point is I'll have Dr. Mitchell explain to you and to your listening audience what the project is about.
Since the pandemic, before the pandemic, we started working, and we were really trying to figure out what were some of the critical issues that was facing Gary and why the city and the citizens weren't moving forward. And we realized that there was some the vehicles were not in place for us to really activate some of the things. So utilizing our resources and our networks, we came together with and got behind two nonprofit organizations. One is the Gary Eastside Community Development Corporation, and another is the Computer Skills and Training Center. And what we managed to do was to acquire not only several grants, but also a few facilities that we're putting back online. And that's what tomorrow is really all about, doing the public announcement, letting the community know what we have going on. So at the former Willow Glen Academy site, we have transitional housing. And that transitional housing is for folks that have fallen on hard times, and those hard times could be women or domestic violence, children aged out of the foster care system, to provide them transitional housing for 6 months to a year. In that time period that they're with us, we've acquired a Department of Labor grant that allows us to do training, not only for that population, but also a reentry population, and that is training in the construction skills with NCCER and with manufacturing skills, MSSC, as well as the culinary arts. And so with that, we provide the training and wraparound services ranging from mental health to life skills and high school. And if they don't have a high school diploma, get in that high school diploma. And with a relationship with Ivy Tech where they can continue on to get their associate's degrees in these various fields that gets them ready for gainful employment and a workforce in Northwest Indiana. The great thing about this grant is that we have to work with employers, which is why the chamber is really important for this initiative to happen. And those employers come on side and they give our participants opportunity for employment in Northwest Indiana. We've also partnered with the Indiana Federal Home Loan Bank, and through that program, after they are gainfully finished our program, become gainfully employed for a year, then we have another program for home ownership where they can go and purchase one of our homes if they have a credit score of 560 or greater. And so now we're talking with that. We move people from cradle to career, but also we move people from homelessness to home ownership. A second grant that we have is from the Indiana Department of Education. And that grant is part of our post-pandemic recovery efforts, where we're working with highly qualified teachers and mentors and churches, one church, one school, in a community. And with that, we are working with children and providing them with life skills, social-emotional learning, trauma-informed care, restorative justice, because we know that after the pandemic, our students are coming back with a lot of stress and trauma that's in our lives that we have to address first before education can really take place and get rooted and seeded to have these young folk move them onto that path of success and their academic endeavors. Along with that, we have a robust STEM program and a robust leadership program. And with those programs, we, along with the wraparound service, we're able to address the needs of the children holistically, from some of the traumas they face as well as the academic challenges that they face during the pandemic era.
Both of these grants are going for about 2 years, 2.5 years, but of course we've been doing this work for probably over 25 years I've been in the education space. And we just hope that what we've put together, that we're able to galvanize and motivate the community to come around and work with us to really make a significant impact in Gary. And the things that I share with you have not only a community impact, but also an impact in our youth, but greater than that is an impact in our economic development of this city that we all know and love.
I think Dr. Mitchell did a great job of summarizing that. And from a chamber perspective, what they are doing has touched all of the bases of which people are saying are lacking in terms of some of the skills, some of the employable people in the community. And so when we look at what's happening in Gary, potential development along the lakefront, and people coming in to invest in Gary, even entities like Hard Rock and other businesses, they're crying for skilled employees and employees in certain areas. And the fact that they are going to address those things, I see them as pioneers in that it's such a holistic approach that it's going to address the needs of almost everybody. And so when we can prepare more citizens and have more Gary citizens prepared in order to be able to benefit from the job opportunities that's going to be created in their own community. So if you ask if the chamber is excited, we're on the verge of delirium.
It certainly sounds that way, to be sure. Let me just ask one question, Dr. Mitchell. As you and Pastor Walton get this program underway, do you have a goal? How many people you would like to get involved at first as you get started?
Oh, yes. To let you know, on the reentry side, we want 70 folks that have been, we're going to say, justice involved. And on the student side, we're looking for 300. But the long-term goal of the housing component, we're looking at doing 1,000 homes in the next 5 years. And so we've set up facilities to do that. And part of our construction program is we acquired a building that's 74,000 square feet that will house this training program. But part of the training program also has a component that's not complements that training program, and that is a new company coming in to build pre-manufactured walls, roof truss, and floor joists. And that allows us to put these houses back into the community, new houses back into the community that people can be really proud of and that are affordable. And so it's like Chuck was saying, it's a holistic approach to community development.
Hey, Chris, the other thing, too, and Dr. Mitchell might be too modest to suggest that they are not on a maiden voyage. They're pretty much doing these things now in their existing facility. They're doing solar panel training. They're doing jobs. In fact, in the existing facility that they have, they've already renovated housing for folks. They've got, at least 4 units, isn't it?
Yeah, we have 7 units.
7 units that they provided housing already. And so what this grant will enable them to do, and, of course, the assistance that may be rendered from the state and the community and others, they're simply going to just be expanding on what they're already doing. And that's what's comforting to me, is that they're not novices. They're not anyone who just has an idea, don't know what to do. They're just going to enhance a plan that's already developed. So that's why I really applaud these gentlemen, because they're already doing it. And now their works will be rewarded, and in the interim, more citizens will benefit.
Chuck, let me ask you finally here. Have you had a chance to talk with members of the chamber ahead of time now, get some ideas of whether you're going to have a big support for getting the people working that hopefully this training program will provide?
Chris, without a doubt. In fact, I haven't had the in-depth discussion with Dr. Mitchell or Mr. Walton, but we already have members who are already talking about partnering and engaged. There are folks who are just waiting to see someone lead this kind of initiative. And so we have other chamber members, Chris, who are endeavoring to do the same thing. And the beauty of it is I see a comprehensive partnership, because Pastor Walton and Dr. Mitchell are open to collaboration, cooperation, and that's what makes it so beautiful that once we start to combine these resources in addition to the funds that they've received and the resources available from other members and the expertise, let's don't minimize that we're bringing people in already in the construction trades and the education field and the business community. And so there's a lot to be excited about, and we expect a very representative participation at the press conference tomorrow with the mayor and others as well. And so I'm trying to, it may not sound like it, but I'm trying to temper my excitement because as a chamber executive, these are the kinds of movement activities that we all want to see happen.
Chuck Hughes is the president and CEO of the Gary Chamber of Commerce, and we're talking as well with Dr. Marlon Mitchell, working on this project. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in the Miller section of Gary in the late 1960s through the 70s. And it was typical white, suburbia, middle class upbringing. But it was changing. Everything was in flux back then in the late 60s and early 70s in Gary. What was predominantly a white community, especially in Miller, which is the more affluent section of Gary, you know, to this day probably. So everything was in flux. And I was living in this little, as I call it, a Wonder Years kind of existence, you know, the Kevin Arnold Wonder Years, and everything was just kind of like that. And that was my bubble I lived in. And I didn't realize all the bigger forces swirling around me in this big city of Gary and all this tumultuous change. I just didn't think of that at all. So I was quite content and quite happy. And then as I got into middle school, that's when we were taught more about race relations. I went to Kennedy King Junior High for Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. So a lot of these things were taught to us. And they're saying this is a perfect model city to watch this in action. These race relations and these bigger things are happening in the country and the world and in this little city. So I realized that my little wonderbread existence of Miller was not quite what I thought it was. It was bigger and broader than that. And there was one instance that happened in high school that I remember really well. I was in band class. I was like a band geek in school. I played saxophone. And I always competed with other saxophone players for the first, second, and third chairs. And one of the kids' name was Alfred Hammonds. I'm pretty sure that's his name. And we would compete back and forth. He was a black kid. And we'd compete back and forth for first chair of alto saxophone. It was a little bragging rights thing, okay? This is a Wirt High School in Gary now. But one day, it was a heavy snowfall. And school got let out a little bit early so we can get our buses early, have our parents pick us up early. And we had a little extra time on our hands. So what did kids do in a snowstorm? They had a snowball fight. And typically, it'd be like the jocks and the heads and potheads and geeks and freaks and band geeks. You know, you go to your certain cliques and then you just team up and you go at it. But in this day, it teamed up white versus black for the most part. And I saw Alfred and I throwing snowballs at each other with zeal and zest and maybe some animosity or just because we're supposed to do it. And we both looked at each other, I thought, at that moment and go, oh, this is not the same as it used to be. We're no longer band geeks. We're no longer jocks and heads as much. It's kind of a race thing. So we separate on those lines. You know, I believe these days there's 10% over here and 10% over there. It's the 80% in the middle that is the determining factor. And those 80% are like lemmings or sheep, and they can get swayed so easily. And I think I was part of the 80% that just got swayed so easily. I mean, there's no way at that age, I was 16 or 17, that I would jump on the black side with Alfred Hammond and start throwing at these white jocks and heads. I just didn't have it in me. I didn't even think about it, actually. I think we reconciled it, and we kind of compartmentalized it and just put it to the side. We were still fine. We were still buds in class and competing and playing music together. We, you know, created music together. You know, that's a synergy right off the bat that kind of transcends even race and other issues and problems. We were fine. It wasn't that big of a deal. But I did notice that things changed. Today, I would discuss it in a heartbeat. I would love to meet Alfred Hammonds again and talk. Do you remember that? No. Oh, okay, sorry. You know, I would think he probably would not remember it at all. To me, it's like some landmark, you know, issue that happened in my life involving race relations in this region.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. We'll be back with you tomorrow.